Welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well podcast. If you're passionate about mastering self-leadership, then you're in the right place. I have always been curious about and fascinated by the pursuit of leadership excellence. This is why I pursued my PhD in psychology with a specialization in business, and I've continued to dedicate my career to understanding the science and practice of positive leadership. My name is Craig Dowden. I'm a best-selling author, award-winning keynote speaker, executive coach, and member of the Forbes Coaches Council. Each week, I'll bring you world-class content on the science and practice of positive leadership. Through my conversations with best-selling authors, TED speakers, and top CEOs, you'll be able to leverage their insights and experience so you can maximize your potential and be the leader the world needs you to be. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Do Good to Lead Well VIP webinar and podcast series. I'm your host, Craig Dowden. Thrilled to have you join us today. Really excited about this conversation. We're going to dig into some really important thought-provoking issues during this episode. And for those who are attending live, really excited to hear your questions. Always like to begin and provide a bit of context where the Do Good to Lead Well podcast series was born. And this was in advance of my first book, Do Good to Lead Well, The Science and Practice of Positive Leadership. And in my executive coaching work, my keynote speaking work and consulting work with organizations, I have the profound privilege to speak with top CEOs, global thought leaders, best-selling authors, TED speakers, to hear their expertise, their insight, their experiences around what they're seeing in the context of business and leadership. And during the pandemic, really broadened that conversation and made it a more frequent discussion, and really wanted to open this up to a community of individuals who are also passionate about these issues. And so over the last year and a half in the existence of the Do Good to Lead Well program, we are now ranked in the top 0.5% of all podcasts globally. This could not have happened without your ongoing support, your energy, your enthusiasm, your feedback, and your ideas. So a heartfelt thank you. And the primary reason why the podcast gets such a strong listenership is because of the amazing guests who kindly devote their time and their expertise with us and share their experiences. And as I mentioned, this is a very special episode. I've been looking forward to this as soon as we're able to get this in the calendar. I've had the privilege of knowing Goldie for some time. And Goldie's the CEO of the Business Council of Canada. I'm going to give a short bio because we couldn't go through everything today. Goldie is a seasoned strategic leader with more than 25 years experience advising business leaders, boards of directors, government officials, and a broad spectrum of community stakeholder groups. As president and chief executive officer of the Business Council of Canada, he represents Canadian business leaders across the country and around the world. BCC is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization whose membership is comprised of more than 170 chief executives and entrepreneurs of Canada's leading and largest companies. Goldie works directly with these leaders to develop and promote sensible public policy solutions in support of economic growth, including in the areas of the energy transition, innovation, industrial policy, cybersecurity, supply chain resilience, workforce development, and trade diversification. He led the BCC through the COVID-19 pandemic, helping coordinate the Canadian business community's response to the crisis. And for those of you who are familiar with Goldie and his work, just an extraordinary leader, and his passion for Canada and Canadian business, to me, is unparalleled. He's the member of the board of directors of Open Text Corporation. He has a long track record of service on behalf of several charities and nonprofit organizations, including the Coalition for a Better Future, the Business and Education Higher Education Roundtable, and Canada's World Trade Organization Business Advisory Council. He sits on the advisory boards of two leading organizations promoting advancement of women leaders, Catalyst Canada and the 30% Club Canada, and is a member of the selection board for A Seat at the Table, an initiative to encourage greater representation of people with disabilities on corporate boards. He's a regular commentator in Canadian media on business, politics, and leadership. He's also the host of the Speaking of Business podcast. I cannot recommend it enough. I believe 100 episodes in, just filled with incredible insights. So please check it out, which features interviews with Canadian innovators, entrepreneurs, and business leaders. So without further ado, Goldie, an incredibly warm welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well podcast.
Thank you for having me, my friend. Great to see you and congratulations on all your success. It's amazing.
And as I shared at the outset, your passion and how you show up and the questions that you urge us to ask ourselves and the positions that you take really drive such incredible dialogue. What I'm really excited about today, you just have such a unique view of what's happening both within Canada and around the world. So to start our conversation, Goldie, where do you see the challenges and opportunities for Canada as well as Canadian CEOs and business leaders during this time?
Let me first say that I am but a voice for my members, as I am reflecting their love of Canada, their passion for our country, their wish that we would be even better than we already are. So a lot of that comes from what I see, what I hear, what I feel from members across this country, most of whom are leading Canadian headquarters companies, others who come from other parts of the world, because they feel Canada is the place where they want to do business. So to your question specifically, there's a half-past version full of this, Craig. There's a half-past version that says things are great for Canada. Not a lot of other people would want to live anywhere else, but in this country, or we have proximity to the United States. We're blessed with natural resources, from water to energy to agriculture to minerals. The list goes on, uranium, potash, you name it. We have trade agreements with about, I think, 55 countries or so that get us access to 1.5 billion people that's available to us. We have immigration policy that allows us to grow our, in a population perspective, which can lead, of course, to growth more broadly. The list goes on. It's truly a great place. But I said it's the half glass full version. There's also a half glass empty version. And unfortunately, in my business, I have to put a lot more emphasis on that, because we jeopardize the half glass full version if we don't address the things that are occupying the half glass empty. And by that, I mean, and to your question, what is keeping CEOs, you know, what's top of mind in terms of challenges? The list is long. Let me be as brief as I can be. First and foremost, I think we're very cognizant that leadership, the way we understood it to be in politics, has evolved from leadership to more followership. I'm struck by the narrative that political parties that I studied and in my academic background are now really referring themselves as movements. Everybody's becoming a movement. We need leaders for the country, not for the movements. And so what we're trying to do as business leaders is to say, so how do we, you do politics, we'll do business. What do we need? What environment do we need to do that? The number one thing I would say to you is good, sound public policy, because money and capital will be attracted to that. If you have a good business investment environment, if you have predictable regulatory regimes that are stable, that don't go yin to yang after every election, most of these businesses, if not all of them, I would say, are on team democracy. Our CEOs want to see democracy do well, but democracies are struggling, not just here in Canada, but around the world. And part of it is this movement thing, but I think it's also the populism that's entered our politics. It's becoming a difficult place to do business. And we can talk more about that, but I'll just say the final thing is what we're seeing here in Canada, that is, on many levels, deeply disturbing. And I don't think Canadians themselves agree with this, but the anti-business rhetoric and the anti-profit rhetoric. I mean, I thought we're a democracy and we're a free enterprise. I didn't realize we were converting ourselves to a more socialist or even worse agenda here. And if that's the case, you should run on that. That should be what we should be having our elections about. I think Canadians would reject that. I think Canadians believe in free enterprise. I think Canadians believe in our small businesses and our big businesses. And I think they want us to be successful. And I guess it's my job to find a way to make sure that the public policy allows for that to happen. Because if not, capital moves.
No, absolutely. And I love that. And already getting some great comments in the comment section around this. And one issue I'd love to explore with you, Goldie, is that we just see, and you touched on this, that decline in trust, like we're just seeing this precipitous decline across the board. And you also talked about it can be really challenging to have constructive conversations, because there are tough issues in front of us where we need to be working together to figure it out. What are your thoughts in terms of what we're seeing in the trust spectrum, and what can all of us do? Every single person here listening to the podcast, be it a business leader, be it a Canadian citizen somewhere around the world, what are some elements that we can bring to look to push that conversation forward?
First thing we should do is demand better. We need to elevate this debate. We need to elevate the discourse. Treat Canadians with respect. There are smart people. I go to sleep comfortably despite all the things I'm going to say today, because I believe in the collective wisdom of Canadians. I think we're a smart group of people. I think we need to be better engaged ourselves and better informed ourselves and see through the noise that is social media. And by the way, that's at the margins. Like, the vast majority of Canadians are not doing that. They're going about their daily lives. I think we have to elevate the debate to having a discussion where Canadians can get together and have dialogue and debate and discuss. And you know what else, Greg? It's okay for them to disagree. We don't have to run to our corners and say, oh my God, I'll never talk to Craig again. That's not how we built this country. We had disagreements and we found a way forward. And what we're seeing now is, I think facts are no longer the center of a discussion and a debate. You know, we stood firm as business leaders on the facts. You can't make stuff up. So I have to say, hey, listen, in a world where we're serious about climate change, does it make sense that we're letting Korea and Japan and China and India increase their reliance on coal? You know, Canada exports thermal coal, but we're limiting the amount of LNG that we can get out of this country. Those are facts that need to be discussed. Nuclear. For the longest time, environmentalists have said, no nuclear, no nuclear. Now, even our prime minister has said, you know what, I was wrong about that. We're going to have to change our point on nuclear. But we lost a decade of investment. We lost a decade of innovation. We lost a decade of opportunity. Now we're going to play catch up. You know, but there's probably 1,000 nuclear reactors on global will be required in the world. Canada can be at the forefront of that. We're a very innovative people. We're looking at carbon capture projects that will be taking place in my home province of Alberta. They're going to put billions and billions of dollars into what, Craig? Into an exercise for which there's no money to be made. This is just do good. Capture carbon, move it, store it. Maybe someday it's worth something, but right now it's just a business line item that costs you money. But yet we're prepared to do our part, work with governments to find a way to do that. Hydrogen, I could go on and on. If we can have an honest conversation and elevate the discussion and the debate, I think what you'll find is we can give faith to our institutions. We don't, as a federation, even meet prime minister and premiers anymore. That doesn't happen anymore. I grew up watching the FMC meeting. I'm not saying that that's the be-all, end-all, because they're usually a catch grab for all the provinces. But it makes the sense that your country is like your executive team of the nation never meets. It doesn't meet. You have a bilateral with your COO. You have a bilateral with your CFO. You have a bilateral with your HR. But you never pull the group together and say, what are we trying to do here in this country? I've often said that if Canada were founded today, we'd probably be a European Union. We would probably be 10 provinces and 3 territories, or however you want to add it up, and we would probably never have a national highway or a national railway system that built the fabric, the soul, and the foundation of this country that makes Canada what it is today. And so I think if we can restore confidence in our institutions rather than destroy it, and look, this is not unique to Canada. I mean, I'm looking at surveys down in the United States where 75% of Republicans are saying they will not accept the outcome of the election if Donald Trump loses. 55% of Democrats said they will not accept the outcome if Donald Trump wins. I'm like, have you ever in Canada said, you know, I'm questioning the validity of, I mean, one of my good friends, a part of the coalition, is Anne McClellan. We call her Landslide Annie, because I think she won her riding by 11 votes. You know, it was recounted. It was 11, and everybody accepted that she won by 11. We had confidence that our system worked. But now we're attacking our media. We're attacking our central bank. We're attacking big business. We're attacking academia. We're attacking government. The list goes on. We're attacking international institutions. Those institutions are the pillars on which democracies and some kind of global order has prevailed. In the absence of that, Craig, I shudder to think what kind of anarchy that results in. I'm not trying to be dramatic. Just see the U.S.
No, absolutely. And the point, and there's so many great points that you made, Goldie. This is why I'm so excited about having this conversation. I love how you're putting the emphasis on constructive disagreements. Like, disagreements are great because you learn, and we learn, and we can expand our thinking. It refines our thinking. It allows us to see other people's perspectives, which, if we are going to move forward together, this is vitally important. We can't just kind of carve people out in different positions. It just doesn't go anywhere.
I always use the analogy of a marriage. You're never going to go through marriage agreeing all that. It's probably easier on us if we just did that as guys, but that's for another day. You're going to have issues. You're going to have conflicts. You're going to have problems. You're going to have fundamental disagreements, perhaps about core things. How many kids should we have? Where should we live? You find a way through dialogue, through discourse, through listening, through understanding, through bringing different perspectives together. In some cases, bringing mediators together, but to find a way forward. If I can, I wanted to find out where I could introduce the coalition. You mentioned it in the introduction. I want to talk about that just a little bit if I can, because I want to give a proof point to my confidence in Canadians. So this group, which is called the Coalition for a Better Future, you can look it up at canadacoalition.ca and en français aussi, but I'll spare you my Alberta version of that. If it didn't exist today, we would go out and build it. And the reason is this: we are seeing what's happening in our politics. We have a segregation, not unique to Canada again, I want to be clear, left and lefter and right and righter. And yet the vast majority of Canadians are what my father calls the people of the radical middle. They're losing voice. They're losing voice and they're actually losing confidence in their institutions. And we as business leaders said, what can we do? We have capacity. We have resources. We have power. How do we use that for good? We reached out to over 125 or so organizations that are from a disparate group of Canadian society, labor movement, Indigenous groups, gender groups, academia, small business, big business, everybody but government. We said to government, you can come and observe. You work for us. You can come and listen to us about what we want out of our governments today. This happened just in between where we thought COVID was over at Omicron. And over 120 groups got together. And I had asked many of them. I said, look, if we could just leave our partisanship at the front door, if we could leave our industry issues at the front door and just ask ourselves a central question, what do we need to do to make life better for our kids and our grandkids? You know why that's an important question, Craig? It's an important question because we're the first generation in the history of society to actually not do that. When I speak on campuses, I begin with an apology. I'm here to say sorry that we made a mess of the world, whether you're talking fiscally, whether you're talking in our institutions, whether you're talking about the climate, whether you're talking about polarization in our politics, whether you're talking about infrastructure, crumbling infrastructure, affordability. It's on us. Every generation before us made life better for our kids and our grandkids. And we said, can we just do that today? And magic happened, Craig. Magic happened. What happened was people decided to put that stuff at the front door. And under the leadership of Anne McLellan and Lisa Raitt, a liberal and a conservative, but really two powerful, well-informed, intelligent, high EQ women, were able to bring people together to actually have that conversation. Agree to disagree, listen to each other. People wanted a variety of things. And then at the end of it all, it landed on three simple things. We the people, well, it's an American phrase, but we as Canadians want three things from our government, we told our government. We want a long-term economic growth strategy because we don't see one. We've basically gotten by on luck, geography so far. Two, we need to lead the world in the energy transition, and it is a transition, and it includes the energy sector. It's not something we can just wish away. And thirdly, we need to address growing inequality in our society, because if we don't, the consequence is even more populism. Look, say what you will about Donald Trump, 80 million or some odd number of people voted for him. They can't all be crazy. There are completely normal, rational people who feel that despite everything, he has given them voice. He has given them hope. He says, I see you. I see your struggles. I don't know how I can relate to you. I have a gold toilet and a penthouse in New York, but I'm one of you. And people, you know, storm Congress for him. That is what we need to make sure never comes to Canada. We need to make sure that we respond and we work together. And I'm very proud of the work that the coalition's doing, where I'm just one member of that organization. There's an advisory committee and others. We're putting our second scorecard out there, because if you don't measure it, you won't know how you're doing. And it's not a scorecard that the coalition came up with. It's OECD scorecard. And it has 20 some odd metrics. And what it says is, Canada, there's some things you do really well. Congratulations. There's some things that you're middle of the pack in, you can do better. But my God, there's some really important things that you're horrible at. In fact, last of 38 countries in growth, you will not have prosperity. You will not have civil society. You will not have social cohesion if the country's economics are going to fall apart. And people need to learn that. We cannot finance our way to prosperity. We're not deficit finance our way to prosperity.
Yeah, I love that. And thank you. And what I love, and thank you for sharing about the coalition. And what I really appreciate with the question you're asking is that's a question that we're all invested in answering. It's how can we make the future brighter for everybody? And I love that. And as you say, and then you invite people to share different perspectives. I've got a question. I've got a bunch of questions here. Stan said, Goldie, thank you for your passion and all the work, the incredible work that you do. I really appreciated your comment on tribalism. What strategies have you seen to get people out of their movements and be a part of a collective conversation?
Well, I think I just spoke to it. This, like I said, the coalition didn't exist. It would need to be built today, because with all due respect to those who seek public life, and I say hats off to you for doing it. It's not something I would ever do, I think, but they're doing it. And so what we need to say to them is, what's your purpose? What are you trying to do? You got elected. Is the objective getting elected? Is the objective to leave the playground cleaner and stronger and than you found it? Is it to build the foundation for long-term growth and success for our country? What are you trying to do? And rather than divide us, and by the way, I want to be very clear about this. When we talk about populism, too often it's portrayed, especially in our media, as the right wing. That is not at all true, and that is not at all fair. We have left-wing populism as much as we have right-wing populism. And I've often said, the more the left goes left, the more the right is going to get bigger. And you're seeing it. You're seeing it happen. I've had this conversation with our prime minister. It's not like I disagree with the importance of rights. I'm a minority myself. I have daughters. I have a child with special needs. I care about that, the importance of social justice in our country. But I also know enough to know that all of that gets compromised if you don't create economic growth and economic prosperity, because at some point people say, you know what? That's all nice. I got to eat. I got to educate my child. I wonder why I don't have healthcare. Where's all my money going? Why am I sitting in gridlock? Why doesn't my LRT work in the nation's capital? These are all people who are saying, like, I don't mind this stuff. But if all the emphasis is on that syllable and it's all in all the time, climate, indigenous, gender, everything, all important issues to me. Don't get me wrong. These are friends of mine, allies of mine, people I've worked hard to build relationships with. But even they now understand that after 7 or 8 years of this government, not a lot of progress has been made on emissions. Not a lot of progress has been made on gender equality. Not a lot of progress is being made on some of the issues that they have really put their eggs in this basket on. You're going to get barber care. You're going to get dental care, this care, that care. But if you don't care about the math, you're actually jeopardizing the sustainability of programs that you're introducing to people that they're not going to count on. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, either this same government or another government one day will have to pay the piper, because this is where the facts come back. The credit agencies are watching us. We have a government that misses its spending targets, not within years, within months, right? We have a government that's now created another fiscal anchor, another fiscal guardrail, another guard post of some kind, which is way out in 2026. But when we asked about it, how are you going to get there in terms of the program review? What savings are you going to do? The answer was, no, those are business issues about profits. We're not interested in those. No, these are your policies I'm asking about on behalf of business leaders who are trying to decide, should we invest in Canada? Because if they see a government whose concern is not fiscal, you know what they think? See, they think, I am going to have to pay more corporate taxes, but so are my employees. So it's going to make it harder for me to recruit talent from around the world. And it's going to make it more difficult for me to be able to reinvest my hard-earned profits on behalf of Canadian shareholders in many cases. Your pension plans aren't investing. They're here. your bank stock, your energy company stock, that's all a part of your TFSAs and your RSPs. If you want that, you want to harm them and benefit foreign companies and give them the subsidies, why don't we put in some kind of a plan together to grow our economy? Like, that's how you do this. And I don't think, I mean, I'm willing to be challenged on anything I say, but you're not entitled to your own facts. That's the one thing I won't bend on. If you find any one of us saying something that's not factually true, call us out on it. Let's have that conversation.
And for me, I'm a huge advocate of evidence-based practice. It's all about data, as you say. You can't have your own facts. And something that I love about how you approach issues and topics and engage in conversation and debate, Goldie, is because you say, okay, here are the numbers, here are the data, here are the facts, here are the trend lines. And it might be uncomfortable to talk about. Not talking about it doesn't make it go away. It exacerbates the challenges. And we need to have courageous conversations. And so I think that's such a critically important point. I wanted to ask you as well, you represent 170 top CEOs, business founders across the country. Do you feel that the role you see focus on CEOs, has the role of CEO evolved, you know, over the past few years? And how do your members, like, what's that like now being a chief executive? Has that reality shifted?
Yeah, it has absolutely evolved and changed. Obviously, COVID was a unique, at least in 100 years, unique phenomena that CEOs had to adjust to. I'll tell you, I've had umpteen number of conversations with CEOs about how they felt that during that major crisis, they basically outsourced leadership to HR and to legal. Tell me what to do. Tell me what I shouldn't do, and I'll do it. And there was a high degree of, darn, I'm going to be a CEO for maybe 5 years, and 2 or 3 years of my life is going to be taken up doing these things. I look back at that and I think that I hope that what people have learned is CEOs are now more than just business leaders. They need to be, and that's not the case, it's always been the case, but like I think in the past as well, CEOs have stepped into the civil arena, the political, not just that political, but the community arena. They have points of view. They are willing to take risks. They were willing. They're more courageous. I mean, I think of someone like Michael McCain, you know, God bless him, but I mean, he's been an exemplary example. Someone who goes out there and just says, you know what, my lawyers told me this, but I'm going to do the right thing. I'm going to own it. I'm going to talk about it. His whole handling of listeriosis is a textbook case of how to manage a crisis, which I know he didn't receive that legal advice on. He said, I have a duty and I want to insert myself. I want to lean in and use this moment to build confidence in the institutions of CEOs. You know what all the surveys and Edelman and all that other stuff shows you is people actually value their CEOs more than their politicians, more than their media. Now, I keep reminding them that's not the highest of bars, so let's not just give it away. I'm not quite Supreme Court justices yet, but hey, you're on the uptick here. And what you find is most people say, I like my CEO. I don't know the other CEOs, and they probably make more money than they should and all that other usual rhetoric. I like my CEO. So what I tell our members is leverage that. Lean in. Your employees are someone's customers, or someone's voters, or someone's taxpayers, or someone's shareholders. It's the same person. Let's engage them. Let's help them understand that if we don't have the proper civil discourse, the proper discussions in our elections about our public, we've had two elections that, let's put it this way, we've had 7 federal elections, 5 minority governments in a country that really has only 2 parties that form power. It's not like it's India, where you have to win over 30 parties or whatever the case might be. Why is that? Why is voter decline happening? Why is it in Ontario you can win a massive majority of less than half of Ontarians voting? Not for you, just voting. There's something wrong if we do that. Now, I'm concerned that political parties are very good with that. They know who their voters are. We'll just talk to them. What about the rest of us? So I think CEOs have got to have more presence, more willingness to kind of overrule their corporate comms people and take a little more risk and be a little bit more bold to say, you know what, I have a point of view. I'm going to put it out there. I want to speak up. I have often said, and I can assure you, Craig, this is a subject of much discussion in my membership. Not like there's unanimity. But I will tell you, as someone who comes from the world's largest democracy in India and who has a sort of story behind how we ended up here and everything for another day, what I often tell people, what I do tell people is if you're living in a democracy, and you're afraid of your government, or your government is threatening you or intimidating you in some way, you're not living in a democracy then. I've been here for 4 or 5 governments. I'll be here for more. They'll come and go. We'll all still be here. They work for us. Maybe that reminder needs to come when we speak up and stand up and say, we demand better. We expect better. We thank you for your public service. We're not, you know, condemning what you're doing. What we're saying is include us. Bring us along on this journey. Have that vision. And I think back to your leadership, we need more leaders with vision that tell people, I'm going to take you here and I'm going to pull you, even if you're reluctant. Look at this country. Where's Canada without Brian Mulroney as our prime minister? Even Pierre Trudeau, I mean, pick both sides here. We're not part of the group. Whether you agree or disagree with their policies, they had a point of view, they won elections on it, and they pulled us forward.
Wow, and I love this. And this isn't a question, this is a comment. It's just too good not to share. So Frank said, I'm part of the radical middle, and Goldie, thank you for inspiring me to demand better. I need to get more active. So I want that. Exactly. I think that's absolutely awesome. There have been numerous questions on this, so I will paraphrase because there's multiple people who wanted to ask. So given your lens on CEOs, what do you think are the key qualities that we need to now develop and grow in our leaders for the challenges of today and tomorrow?
So look, first of all, CEOs are problem solvers. CEOs, they help solve problems. And COVID, again, was the best example of that. It was big business, largely, who took over the PPE shortfall. We had companies that like CAE and Aerospace, or, you know, Linda Hasenfrantz's company over at Linamar, or Danny Reese at Canada Goose. These stories are all documented in a book behind me here called Unprecedented, which is all about the things business did, which didn't get much fanfare because, you know, we weren't coming out every day at 11 o'clock out of Rideau Hall or whatever to say, here's money for this group and that group. And the government did a very good job itself. But you know what the legacy of COVID was, is we worked together. We all worked together. There was a partnership. We agreed to disagree about things. I had some pretty tough conversations about our airlines with our government of the day at that time. And I'm like, it's okay. They didn't do what I asked them to do or what we thought was necessary. That's a choice. It's democracy. It hurt our industries badly. It hurt Canadians badly. But you know what? Canadian people render their judgment on that and how they were reduced to a minority. So we have to be learning from the history of that, which is partnerships is better. Bring people in. The coalition is about bringing people in who can agree to disagree. It's okay, as I keep saying. It's all right. but let's find what we agree on. I'll give you a simple example, childcare. Childcare is a policy, if you look back how it sort of materialized, obviously the government of the day was keen on introducing it. And let me be clear, there's a lot of things we've worked on with governments, liberals, conservatives, NDP, some concoction thereof across this country, to find ways to do things together that will help elevate both the debate and the outcomes for Canadians. Childcare is a great example of that. My friend Hassan Youssef, who is a senator now, is the head of the Canadian Labour Congress. He called me up and he said, look, can you imagine the power of you and me coming out together on the importance of childcare when women in particular, who are affected more by childcare than men are, but not exclusively so, if we need them back to work, you got to bring this about. Let's find a way to work together in the national interest, good for your members, good for my members, good for Canada, is there something wrong if everybody benefits, if it's a win-win-win-win? No, we should find more ways of doing that. And that means listening, hearing, and trying to solve actual problems. And I think COVID, unfortunately, is now in our rearview mirror. We lost all of that.
Well, and thank you. And so many comments coming in about wonderful reminder that COVID, a golden revelation, working together. I think that's the, as you said, people put everything aside and said, okay, now do we figure this out? A vigorous debate, yet we were working together. And that's how you overcome really extraordinary challenges. You can't do it any other way. I've got another question from Amanda who says, thank you, Goldie, for all of the work that you do around increasing representation. I'd love to hear your thoughts in terms of how can CEOs effectively engage from a diversity and inclusion standpoint, and what are some steps that you would like to see businesses and government take in order to fully leverage that potential?
So look, this is easy. Just good business. DEI, CSR, climate, philanthropy. It's just good. It's good to do all of those things. It's good for your business. So it's not like you have to convert people to this. They were doing it. They were there. We put a lot more emphasis on it, and I think for good reasons, around Indigenous in particular, the labor movements, women, as I just pointed out, people with disabilities. We want to be as inclusive as possible because, again, what's one of the issues I hear about in C-suites across this country? Talent, labor shortage, you know, skills, reskilling. You got an Indigenous community that's 50% population below the age of 25. They're keen on education. They're keen on skills. They're keen on moving to get that. They want to have skin in the game. They want equity in projects. One of the reasons we're advocating for the Aboriginal loan guarantee that we're still waiting on from the government to come after several years of what I think should be a no-brainer to, like, let's bring prosperity to the Indigenous communities. That's the best way to bring about reconciliation. We should be doing more of that. So there's no one in my membership, and I bet no one across this country, really, who doesn't understand the value of DEI, CSR, ESG. In fact, what Canadians say is, we expect that of you. And it's table stakes of what you should be doing. And we're going to give you no credit for it. That's okay. We're doing it because it's the right thing to do.
Yes.
It's the right thing to do. It happens to also be good business, right? Mm-hmm. Because it speaks to your customer base. It speaks to the employee base and so forth. I think you're seeing a lot of that. And I think a lot of that has come about in part because governments have put a lot of emphasis on it. But what I would say is they always go overboard, right? You can't travel around the world and try and export your approach in societies that are 2,000 or 3,000 years old. And so everywhere we go, we can't be about, oh, we're here for the SMEs. It's a complicated big world out there. Every SME is relying on big business to be successful because they are our supply chain. So when Canadian businesses go abroad and make it, they bring that supply chain with them. But you don't lead. You don't sit across the chairman of Samsung or Canon and say, I want to introduce you to the head of the SME. Lovely. But that doesn't reflect the seriousness with how we should be doing our global trade. That is our secret sauce in Canada, in addition to immigration, is the fact that we're a trading nation. And we can do good and grow our economy and then talk to them about, look, it's really important for you to also think about diversity and so forth, right? You don't lead with it to go. Look, I'm not the one saying this. What I get told by people is you guys show up and we feel like we're going to get a lecture. That's not the best way to do business, right? And so one of the things we've done here, Craig, at the Business Council is we've introduced, and we've been doing it for a long time, but I guess I've given it structure, is we have a vertical called commercial diplomacy. We no longer just leave it to business, or sorry, to government to be our voice. We have to have our own presence. So we've opened an office in Washington. We have one in Brussels. We're opening one in Indo-Pacific. So you'll start seeing a footprint of the Canadian business community having its own voice, its own capacity, its own ability. Because you know what? From time to time, we are going to disagree with governments. blue, red, orange, turquoise, everything in between. It's okay, as I keep saying. It's all right.
I love it. No, I think that's such an important piece. And also, I love how you frame it. You know, when people are looking at, oh, here I come with a lecture on such and such right away, that's going to shut the conversation down. I've got another question coming in. This is great. So many questions coming in. Tanya was saying, really appreciate your perspective, Goalie. Very inspiring. Hear a lot about innovation and the importance of being innovative in Canadian companies. Like, what do business leaders need to do? What does Canada need to do to be more innovative?
Well, look, if you look at what's happening with AI, if you look at what's happening with quantum, the hubs in Montreal, the hubs in Waterloo, Toronto, U of A and Edmonton, these are world leading. And we have an opportunity to be at the forefront of that. I am not here to just say all Canada should do is natural resources. I'm saying we should do natural resources plus, plus, plus. We have ingenuity. We have the immigration policy to support it. We have access to the G1 economy, which is our neighbor. We have, as I mentioned, access to $1.5 billion with our trade. These are all the elements that allow for Canada to actually have something we don't have, right? And that is, it's a loaded term for some. I'll use it anyway. So the notion of an industrial policy. I say, why don't we just call it a growth strategy? Heck, why don't we just say, what do we want to be when we grow up? Because so far, it's been darn easy to be Canadian. Not just Canadian. Even Canadian businesses have had a pretty easy run. It's not hard if America's your neighbor. You've got an English-speaking country. You've got a democracy. I know that's fluctuating these days, but a democracy. You've got rule of law, again, maybe fluctuating these days, but for the longest time, it's been there. You've got proximity. You've got relationships. You've got access. You've got time zones. It's been easy to just focus and do the ride with the Americans. They go up, we go up. They go down, we go down. But at the end of the day, when the G1 economy is what it is, and look what they're doing with the IRA, I mean, they can subsidize their way and create deficits. Eventually, that'll catch up to them as well, because math is math. Someday, that'll catch up to them. But now we have to ask ourselves, how much is America changing? How much is our relationship with America changed? I'm very worried that we're not seen as their best friend necessarily, that we have work to do. I'm glad the government's launched an initiative that we're fully in support of, with no daylight between us and the government, to say, yes, let's make sure Team Canada's down there telling the Americans how important our relationship is. It's also diversified. Let's make sure that we're hedging our bets a little bit. I'm on my way with a delegation of CEOs to Malaysia, to Vietnam, to Korea, to Nigeria, to Philippines, to Indonesia, all this year. All this year, because they're starting to realize that we've got to have other places from whom we can grow our businesses. And so this is, I think, an opportunity for Canada on not just the natural resources, but also technology. Every single company, I say, is on a journey to being a technology company. I don't care if you sell screwdrivers or widgets or donuts. We are all on a journey to being a technology company. And the impact of AI, like, we are at the beta level of this. We're on the ground floor of this, if not the basement. What is coming at us is the change equivalent to the internet having come about, where everybody holding a handheld phone, walking around with everything they can possibly imagine in their hand. This is fundamental change that's about to take place. And the way AI works, the impact of it is going to be exponential, and it's going to happen really on top of each other. Unlike, you know, the 40 years it took to get 30% of houses with TVs and another 40 years to get phones or whatever. This is happening. It's happening now. And we can be in the front of it, but we got to work together. You can't have regulatory. Every meeting I ask our members, what's keeping you up at night? What's the issues? And every time, regulations is number one on the list. We get in our own way. We have a government now that is obsessed on groceries. There are at least eight different grocery chains in this country. Three of them are multi-global national, like Amazon and Costco and Walmart. Margins in this business are like 5%. We're going to be raking them all over the coals. We're actually asking them to collude to bring prices down, which is not even allowed by law. This is silly. You know, we have profits are bad. When did profits become bad? This is not constructive. It's not helpful. And it's not going to lead to the solutions that regular people are stressed about. Why are my kids in my basement after 2 degrees? Why is it that they can't afford a house? Why is it that I sit for an hour and a half or so to get to work and to come back to work? For those of us who work, not like in Ottawa, there's a lot of people doing that, let me tell you, but that's for another day as well.
That's part two of the webinar. Yeah, that's right. Bonus. After hours. I've got a question. This is great. And it sounds like a debate. Lisa said, counterpoint. There are lots of CEOs who have dived into speaking out, stating their opinions, and got it really wrong. How are you advising CEOs on speaking up authentically, not becoming a viral moment and then becoming, and yes, I'm a comms person?
You've answered your own question in your question, and that is the word authenticity. One of the things I think that is going to set people apart, why I use Michael as an example, but I can go down a long list. I look at someone like Jeff Orr, CEO at Power Corp. He had said in one of my podcasts, I think it's something around like, live your personal values in your professional life. And that struck me because what he's saying is be who you are always, not someone else as a CEO, someone else as a father or mother, someone else as your neighbor. Have those values to be consistent because then you're authentic. And when you're authentic, you get a lot more leeway to get it wrong. That's what Michael improved. Now, I hate to keep coming back to him, but he's the poster child for someone who overrode all the comms, all the legal advice, and he said, no, I have to do the right thing. Those are my values. Those are the McCain family values. And I have to do that. I have to apologize. I have to create restitution. It's easy to just hide behind waters. I think authenticity is absolutely the key. And I'll have you know that anytime I speak to, and I love speaking to campuses of MBA classes and others, I tell them this important thing. Be who you are. You have one life, the best I know, it's short. Be who you are. Don't spend it being somebody you're not. You will benefit from that when you get it wrong, and you'll absolutely benefit from it when you get it right. And let's hope you get it way more right than when you get it wrong.
Well, I love that, and thank you. And got a lot of positive comments in the chat, Goldie. And it reminds me of, I had the privilege of collaborating with Alan Mulally for my latest book. And then he defined authentic leadership, which I love and I think is just so beautiful in what you just shared. It's when our values, beliefs, and behaviors are in alignment, and people only see our behaviors and then make assumptions around values and beliefs. I love how you're commenting on that because that's so powerful, and the values become that anchoring piece. One of the things, and I'd love to get your take on this, because my thought process is when we can approach a conversation or every interaction and relationships that we have with authenticity and values based, well, when we disagree, you know what I'm standing, and we can talk around that. I'd love to get your take on that and how values help direct those discussions and communication.
Look, I spent 17 years of my life and my career at a company called Hill & Knowlton. Mm. I had lots of options to go to a lot of different public relations, government relations companies, small, medium, large. I chose it for two reasons. First and foremost is leadership. I was going to a place where I saw a leader that I could be mentored by and groomed by and learn from. I'm grateful for that opportunity. I wouldn't be here without it. The other reason was this leader believed in values. They didn't change. They hung on the wall, but they weren't just something on the wall. They were practiced. They were honored. You have a little bit of a shelf life or elasticity to you violating those. You will get called on it, but you won't do it again. You know, and one of the values that I cherished the most and I bring to me in any role that I do is the value of constant improvement. The idea that none of us are ever done, that if you're done, it's probably because you're 6 feet underground somewhere. The chance to learn, the chance to grow, and I hear that in my podcasts all the time. I remember Jeff Smith over at Ellis Dawn had great liners. So just get out of the way. Get out of the way. Trust people. Let them do what it is that they're able to do. Tracy Robinson, my vice chair at the Business Council of Canada, now the CEO of CN, said, you know, the most important thing I can do is the value of trust. That if I have a good company and I've created expectations and clarity and mandates and clarity and job descriptions and all of that, I should trust the people to do what they do. I don't need to I'm not a micromanager myself. I don't like to hover and ask all the time. I'll know if you get your work done, don't get your work done. But most importantly, I want you to know what you can come in and talk to me if you're having a challenge or it's not an indictment on you that you couldn't do it by yourself. So I really believe strongly in that. And as I listen to sort of the expectations of our next generation of leaders, I hope that they take the time to learn from the leaders of the past or even the leaders of the present. And I think of two in specific, Dave McKay, CEO of RBC, and Jennifer Wong at Aritzia, whom I just did a podcast with. These are two people whose entire life and career has been spent in those two companies that I just mentioned. And I remember Dave saying in a presentation where he was voted as CEO of the year by an organization, and he said, you know, somewhere in my life early on as I was a teller and I was working my way through the bank, it just hit me, why can't I be CEO one day? Like, why not me? What a great question. And he was able to get there. Jennifer Wong, just now on the podcast, talked about how Aritzia had two stores in Vancouver. She went to the first one where the owner apparently were, and he didn't hire her. And unbeknownst to him, she went to the other store, went hired, and she's CEO today, 30 years later. I think we should learn from the lessons, because not everybody is born with a silver spoon. Not everybody went to Harvard, got an MBA, and became a CEO of a bank. The story of Victor Dodig, my own board chair today. You know, they came with him and his brother, young parents cleaned houses, did whatever it did to make ends meet, and got in one generation to the place that those two brothers have gotten to. We should celebrate the success of these people. Calin Revenescu, former CEO of Air Canada, landed here age 4 or 5, I think it was, not a word of English or French. Okay? Look what he was able to do. And so I think we should make sure that today's leaders who are aspiring leaders learn from the leaders from the past that got us to where we got to.
And I love that. And again, so many great comments coming through. And I think, Goldie, your message around continuous improvement, continuous learning, curiosity,
being curious. Huge. One of my favorite sections of the podcast is, tell me about your failures.
Right.
Tell me about a failure. Because I know from my own experience, I learn way more from my failures. Luckily, they're limited, but they've happened. And believe me, some of them are 30 years ago. I've never forgotten. It's in my mind. Right? That I know that I can't wing it, that I know I have to prepare, that I know I have to work hard, that I know I have to read. We should remember it's not a straight line. We should remind our kids and the next generation of leaders, it's not a straight line. It's okay. In fact, failure teaches you far more. You don't want to do it in volume. You want to learn. But I would say in my podcast, it's always one of the areas that we explore that I really listen carefully to, because people are very honest about, oh my God, how much time do you have? I've had lots of failures. But I'm a very successful CEO today of a multinational company, and I make good money, and shareholders are happy, and the employees are happy, and I'm contributing to society. But it was my failure that helped get me there.
Absolutely. And I love it. And you just put it into the context of the conversations we're having. And you look at the top best-selling books come Amy Edmondson out of Harvard with The Right Kind of Wrong and the importance of failing, and my favorite acronym for FAIL, which is First Attempt in Learning. Because it's all around propelling us forward. I think that's so, so vitally important. And LinkedIn just came out with most valuable skills, adaptability, agility. That's all about continuous learning and improvement. Time has flown by. We've got about 10 minutes left. So this has been fantastic. One of the questions I did want us to explore, Goldie, is around mental health and well-being. Like, that's become a big area of focus, and you're seeing lots of concerning data or in that space. So what are your thoughts in terms of what role does the CEO have in that? What are some key things that each of us can do in terms of our organizations and our communities to have more of a focus on mental health and well-being?
Well, I can tell you, particularly during COVID, mental health was literally one or two outside of keeping people safe on the minds of CEOs that I was speaking to. They were extremely concerned about their employees. Craig, I can tell you stories of people you know and I know and others who prevented suicides on instinct, literally on instinct, that, you know, why is it that Bob never turns on his camera? He hasn't turned on his camera in 2 weeks here. What's going on with Bob? Check in on Bob. The attention that was given to mental health during that time, making sure your employees were eating well, that they were not overworking, that they had access to, you know, the vaccine, and they had access to the rapid screens. I mean, you know, all the things that we were able to do to show Canadians during that pandemic was an important reminder that mental health, for all the wrong reasons, became such a big issue. But it hasn't gone away as a result of COVID subsiding. COVID's probably not gone, probably won't be gone for a long time, but certainly not prevalent as it used to be. Our CEOs are seized with that, because what you're talking about here is, first and foremost, your colleagues. They're your friends. They're people that you work for you. And so, again, it's critically important to make sure that their mental health is addressed and that they have the access to support as needed. So, you know, we're having a debate about some of these things. The truth is, certainly my employers give the insurance. People have access to be able to go and get the mental health supports that they need. You know, I think of one of our CEOs who said to me, a happy employee leads to a happy community, that happy people. And I've often said myself, happy people tend not to be looking for radical ideas, tend not to be polarized, tend not to be angry, right? And in fact, it's a reminder for what drives me every single day is I feel that the antidote we are trying to provide as business leaders to the ills of society, not just in Canada, but writ large, I feel that if we can bring about economic prosperity, bring about economic growth, share it. Okay? There's better work to be done in sharing it. I mentioned inequality earlier. But, you know, wages have gone up, the social cost of living. And so we've got to keep working at that. If we can bring that antidote, the vaccine for our ills, if you will, today is economic growth, economic prosperity, not driven by our governments, enabled by our governments, regulatory regimes, tax regimes that are competitive, that allow others to come here and say, you know what, I want Canada to be the place where I invest. Without my government giving me billions of dollars of subsidies to do it, I want to come here because it's the best place. And I started at the very beginning saying there's a half glass full version. I believe that as much as I unfortunately believe the half glass empty. If we can address the half glass empty and do it maturely and do it honestly, I think the issues like mental health and stuff will decline. There will always be mental health. I'm not naive to suggest there won't be, but the volume at which we're seeing it is due to these reasons. I mean, even work from home has had a different impact on different people. You know, women in particular, I have men have said to me, it's not easy for me. And yet my employer is not encouraging me to come back to work. We're open 2 days or 3 days. I'd come 5 if they asked me to. And then there's the other extreme, which is I never want to come. But then on the other hand, how are you doing? Not just your career in terms of your development, which is likely stalled. You don't have much co-creation, much conflict management, much interaction, much, you know, humor at the water cooler, nothing, none of that. But how are you doing? How do I know how you're doing? I don't know. And yet I worry about you as a leader. And I can tell you, this issue didn't decline as COVID went away. It's still at the top issue in the C-suites because you're talking about, as I said, the well-being of your colleagues.
Absolutely. Well, thank you. And again, lots of amazing comments. And this is wonderful. Thank you, Goldie. Love your passion. Love your insights. Perhaps, you know, you talked about starting with the glass half full and then looking towards the future. What excites you? What are those opportunities that you're really energized around pushing us as the CEO of the Business Council of Canada, and that your members are really looking forward to tackling in a big way?
Well, look, our Prime Minister has often said, this is Canada's moment. Mm-hmm. We agree. We absolutely agree. We just need to seize it. We need to work together to seize it. And it's not an either or choice. We can grow our economy and address the environment. These are not mutually exclusive. On the contrary, they're extremely connected. Business leader, as I just mentioned earlier, to capture carbon is basically all cost. And yet members are prepared to put shareholder money into societal good because it's the right thing to do. We want to see those emissions come down. But you know the thing about emissions, Craig? They don't respect borders. They don't do immigration at the border. They don't do customs. It moves around. And it's the same thing with COVID. It was the same thing with capital. We have got to realize that we need to create a competitive landscape that allows us to work together to seize this moment for our natural resources, for our food security, for our innovative capacity and know-how, for our proximity to the United States, for our trade agreements that we have around the world, for our trying to maintain support for our immigration policy is an existential threat. We don't have an economy that grows without immigration. Do you know that? There's no GDP growth without immigration. Our birth rate fell to 1.3. Kids are being born later. Less of them are being born. It's our moment. But it can also be a moment where we look back and say, I missed it. They didn't take advantage of what was available. You know, I wrote the Prime Minister a little while ago on fiscal responsibility because, you know what, math is math. It's going to come back at us. We're going to see 1993 one day, job losses and, you know, cuts to healthcare, education, et cetera. And I asked about the permitting. Like, why can't we get things built in this country? I asked anybody on this call, tell me the last thing you remember being built of any size and scale in this country. Mm-hmm. India is building over 200 airports today. Australia is redoing the highway system and expanding the electricity grids. All kinds of things are happening in different parts of the world. What are we doing? Let's be ambitious. Because I think the next 150 years could really belong to Canada if we get out of our own way, find a way to work together. And as we say, get her done. In Alberta, I come from a province of stop whining, stop complaining, get her done. I think we can, Craig. I really believe we can.
Well, and thank you. And I couldn't think of a better close for this. And so many comments. I could spend an hour on, so inspiring, so passionate. Love the insight. Love your enthusiasm about Canada. I love the point you just made, Goldie. And I do want to emphasize that. And I love how you're talking about elevating the debate, because I think it's such a powerful point for all of us to reflect on. Are we making a situation of either or when we can benefit from the power of the and? And that's what I love about you and your approach. And I want to say myself, every time I have the privilege to speak with you, I always learn lots of fantastic things. I'm inspired. And what I love when I leave these conversations is that as a Canadian, I'm like, yeah, like that. And so thank you for all that you do for Canadian businesses, for Canadians. You continue to advocate in such a thoughtful, impactful, inspiring way. And so thank you for taking the time. As I said, we spent an hour with all the comments in this comment box about what you're doing. So really appreciate you took some time to join us today on Do Good to Lead Well.
Thank you. And thanks to all those who joined. I really appreciate that you thought it was worthwhile being here. And go Canada.
Yeah. All right, everyone. Until the next episode, take care. Thanks so much for joining us today. Look forward to seeing you soon. Bye for now.
Thank you so much for joining me here today on Do Good to Lead Well. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can follow me on Twitter at Craig Dowden or reach out via LinkedIn or email info@craigdowden.com. I look forward to meeting you here next week for another transformational episode.